Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and we shine a light ahead of us to the path where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together. Really to address problems instead of just defending positions. We have another purpose too, and that is to provide context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Knowing my radio audience a little bit, I imagine people who want to do good, who want to benefit the greater good of each and all, and of course would support programs designed to even the playing field and make things more balanced, right? So who remembers the war on poverty? Well, as the Swami tells us, the war on poverty is over. The poor people have all surrendered. Now, what if there actually is more truth to that joke than we care to see? What if the poverty programs themselves have actually kept the conditions in place? What if the real beneficiaries of these programs have been those who have served the underserved community? And what if these programs actually promote dependency instead of self-reliance? What if the current way of giving help has left people helpless and actually created an industry that makes sure the problem stays in place, largely unsolved? Today's guest, Mauricio Miller, has written a book called The Alternative. Most of what you believe about poverty is wrong. I want to give you a little quote from The Alternative that may shed some light on the shadow of anti-poverty programs. And this was written well over 50 years ago in a letter to pastors. While in the Birmingham jail, Martin Luther King wrote the following, quote, "I have almost reached a regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate," unquote. Noting their paternalism, King continued, "Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will," unquote. Our guest Mauricio's deep understanding comes from his own upbringing in a single-parent family. His mother was proud, resourceful, independent, and smart, found herself up against stereotyped images of who people thought she was, and a social welfare system that ended up discouraging all of those signs of independence. After years of watching that same system disempower and fail to serve the next generation, Mauricio presented California's mayor of Oakland, Jerry Brown, with a radical plan to encourage poor communities to cultivate their own resources and find their own solutions. He founded the Family Independence Initiative in 2001 to capture the stories and data that demonstrate that low-income families, when working together, actually have the capacity to help themselves and help one another towards sustained upward mobility. Now, in recognition of his pretty unconventional approach to generating economic mobility, Mauricio was awarded a MacArthur Genius Fellowship in 2012. He was appointed by President Obama to the White House Council for Community Solutions. He is an Ashoka Fellow, a Prime Mover Fellow, and having met him, I can attest to this, a jolly good fellow. No, seriously, he is also a Purpose Prize winner, among other awards. He was honored with an invitation to President Clinton's 1999 State of the Union address, and he served on bank and philanthropic boards, started small businesses, and we're happy to have Mauricio Miller with us today. Welcome, Mauricio.
Thank you very much, Steve. A very funny introduction, too. Some of it has been comical. Yeah.
That's the whole idea. We chemical dependency is frowned upon. Comical dependency seems to be okay. So let's start with the subtitle of your book called The Alternative. The subtitle, Most of What You Know About Poverty Is Wrong. Let's start there. What's wrong with what we think we know about poverty?
Well, you know, one of the big things for people that are trying to be helpful, and I want to put it together in terms of there's different perspectives, obviously, but one of the most permeated thoughts of people in poverty is that they don't have the capacity to help themselves and that they won't help each other. There's certainly a lot of stories that way. And that if that is the situation and you're kind of have some racist tendencies, then you'll say, well, those are the people we don't want in our country because they don't know how to make good decisions and there's something wrong with them, and so let's kick them out or don't let them come into the country. The other side is the people that want to do good, and they basically, if they carry the same stereotype, and many of them do, that there isn't the capacity, then they say, well, you know, it isn't that these people are bad people. They just don't know how to make the right decisions, and so we're going to go help them make the right decisions, and we'll put together a program so that we can actually put them in the right direction. And both of those stereotypes, that basic stereotype is wrong, but certainly both of those perspectives come together in the fact that they see populations like the family I came from and the neighborhoods and the people I knew growing up, that somehow or other we in those kind of circumstances are in those circumstances because it's our fault. It's our personal fault. It's the way we make decisions, and therefore somebody has to save us or somebody has to exclude us. That's the most
basic. Wow. Yeah. And those are the stereotypes. And it's very interesting because I taught inner city high school in Washington, D.C., and I was shocked to find that many of the teachers who, as we say, meant well, would try to make things easier for black students, and in the process essentially made them less really able to compete and have confidence in the marketplace because they were, well, this person is underprivileged, so we're going to make all of these allowances rather than holding to a standard and really allowing their self-esteem to come from achieving that standard. So is that part of what you've discovered?
Yeah, that really is part of it. What's interesting, though, is that it actually somehow feeds both sides, both the us and them. There was one example noted in the book that I was on a trip and with another MacArthur winner who also had won a Pulitzer Prize, African-American woman, and I was telling her how in the first project that I started with the help of Jerry Brown, where we watched families and what they did, that within 2 years, the income for the groups that were African-American, because we only brought people in groups of their own friends, that the income for the African-American groups had jumped 37% in those 2 years, and the income for the Asians had only jumped 18%. And as I said that, then she had this look of disbelief. And I asked her, well, so, you know, when I told you that, how come you didn't seem, you were so surprised that the black community had done so well? And she thought for a second and she said, so, you know, one of the things that's happened is that many in my community have internalized the racism and all the prejudice that we've faced. And so there is an right. internalization, you know, by the community itself, often of low expectations that somehow or other, especially if the good people think that of you, then you think that, well, maybe that's kind of true. And this is a Pulitzer Prize winner that had low expectations. So, yeah, it becomes really a huge problem on both sides.
Now, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your own background. Your mom came here from Mexico. Why don't you tell that story a little bit and some of what her experience was as a fairly resourceful, courageous individual and trying to make her way as a single mom?
So, you know, like so many people that are immigrants, and certainly that's what this country was really built upon, and escaping, really, whether you were on the Mayflower or whatever, escaping some kind of persecution and wanting a new opportunity. My mother came from Mexico with my sister and I, and she came to San Jose because it was the fastest growing city, and she was ready and had always worked really hard, and she was very smart. She was good at numbers and she was good at design. And she felt that if she brought us to the United States, this is where hard work and talent would be recognized. And so, you know, what she did is she obviously got us into San Jose, lived on Taylor and North First Street, and she went out looking for a job and really quickly realized that as soon as people heard that she had a Mexican accent, the type of questions she was asked really changed. And so she came home one night and said, look at, you are not allowed to speak Spanish anymore because I have to get rid of my accent, because every time they hear my accent, then they're not offering me the job. And so she was very clear that somehow or other, this image people had of her as being a single mom and Mexican really worked against her. And that scenario kept playing out over and over again. She was finally able to get a job, but she was never able to actually show a lot of her talents. So people had already stereotyped her. She was able to get rid of her accent, but she was still dark. The other piece is it wasn't just the racial stereotype of the fact she was an immigrant, but she was also very pretty, and that her bosses would come on to her. Now, this is in the 50s. Oh, this is in the 60s, I guess. And that sexism played such a huge role, and you hear it more happening today where it's becoming, with the Me Too movement, it's becoming clear that, again, that view of her as a woman, and that the standard was that her bosses could come on to her, then both created a problem for her with the men in the office and with the women who also saw that type of thing happening. And every time it happened, then my mother would come home and she'd say, so, you know, he's flirting with me. And I knew when that started happening, then something was going to go wrong. And then one day she'd come in and says, he touched me and I have to get out of there. And the dilemma she had, and this happens to a lot of poor people, is that when they run up into either a racist or somebody who's really sexist, they can't just automatically walk away and think that they're going to be able to get a job at the same scale. She, especially in that time, she needed a letter of recommendation from that guy. And so what I would see is her struggle to try to keep that job, try to be coy with the guy so that he would lay off of her until she could come up with a good enough excuse to quit, that he would then be willing to write her a letter of recommendation. This is not something that rich people that have opportunities have to endure. But my mother had to endure it with both racist people and sexist people, that somehow or other people never recognized that that's a circumstance that continues on to today, obviously.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. So
yeah.
That was the start of the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
go ahead. Yeah.
Well, it was just that, you know, again, my mother would come home and, you know, I was the quiet kid and she would tell me stories, and that I would see her, you know, by this time she was working two jobs because she wanted me to go to college. You know, my sister had gotten in trouble and she wanted one kid to succeed. And so she had two jobs, and then at night she'd come home after her second job. And she would do sewing. And that is where you would see her smile. That is where you could see what her talent really was. And so she'd be on the floor cutting out patterns from newspapers and sewing dresses for quinceañeras, for other friends and stuff like that. And she always dreamed of actually starting a dress shop and being able to actually create a whole business to employ other people. And she really was a talented designer. She could do all this. And she said that when she went to try to get help or any of the people that.
Hello?
Oh. She was talented. They,
yeah. Oops, you're fading in and out. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. So they were not interested in what her talents were. They were interested in what her problems were, and that they would help her solve the problems. And she said, no, really, what I really want is for people to understand what I'm really good at. And if there was just a way for people to help us a little bit, she would say, if they would just give me a little bit of the money they spend trying to help me, we would be so much better off.
You
so
know,
that was the story of my mother. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting that you know, again, when all the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So the tool that these people had was this invisible, in a way, patronizing way of superiority and being superior. All I can do is offer you help, not even the help that you're asking for, because you probably don't even know what you want. You know, that must have been extraordinarily frustrating for you. And then you ended up going into the social service domain yourself. Is that right?
Yes. So, you know, what happened is that my mother obviously wanted at least one of her kids to succeed. My sister ended up getting pregnant by this guy who then married her and took her off to New York and would beat her up. And so, you know, my mother was just totally devastated by that. So it's like, Mauricio, you're going to go to college. And everything, including my mother's health, was really put aside so that one kid could go to college. She told me I had to be a doctor or an engineer. And I, you know, I knew if I became a doctor that a lot of people would die. So I decided to become an engineer. I became an engineer, but I had no idea what engineers did. But my role was to actually get through college, get a job. And I was able to do that. But, you know, there were a lot of things, you know, I was sent to Vietnam and whatever. And finally, when I got back and was able to really be able to provide more for my family, my sister had finally run away from that guy. And my mother knew that I hated being an engineer, so she wanted me to do whatever I wanted to. And so I decided I wanted to go back to design school. And my mother at that point in time needed a lot of operations. I wasn't sure if I was going to tell this part of the story, but my mother needed operations, and we obviously still didn't have a lot of money for myself and my sister. I was trying to take care of my sister and her three kids who had stayed with that guy. And when it turned out that I wanted to get the operations for my mother, I wanted to actually redirect the money that we did have back to my mother, she basically would say, no, that's not why all these sacrifices were made. It was not made for me. And when I went to spend money on her, she knew she couldn't talk me out of it. So she went to Las Vegas and she bought a gun and she shot herself. And wow. So the message was really clear that my role was to help my family and my sister's kids, and not let what was happening to our family happen to other families. And so,
Mauricio, we're about to take a break. We want to pick up on this. We don't want to leave it there's more to be said about this, but we have to take a break. And we'll be back in a few minutes with Mauricio Miller talking about his book, The Alternative. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years. delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
My son shot his brother. 911,
what is your emergency?
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, we're back. This is Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We're back with our guest, Maurizio Miller. And I just want to spend a little time on what you said prior to the break in the level of sacrifice your mother was willing to make in order to have you see the promised land, quote unquote, even if she couldn't. Let's complete on that. Say a little more about what that was like. For your mother to basically say, I'm giving up my life so that you don't have to spend money on my health.
Obviously for it happening in my family, with my mother taking her own life, that in many ways you feel like you're the only one, but then you start realizing that, especially once you become a parent, that you would easily die for your child. And that you see this with refugee families all the time, where they are able to really take all kinds of risks, really to try to improve the life, at least for their children, and are willing to give up their lives. And you see that maybe not as dramatically, but in many, many ways where parents give up food, which is what my mother did, and they give up their own opportunities for the next generation. It is a side of low-income families and people that is not seen in philanthropy and is not seen in kind of the world stage. We see the people that run these big programs or have corporations and maybe some of their contributions, but we don't see the kind of contributions that I saw as I was growing up. And that's sort of what's missing from our social sector, and not just our social sector, but obviously from people that really are much more extreme in terms of their views of low income and immigrants and everything else. For my family, I know that my sister, because she was in an abusive relationship, people also felt that she obviously didn't make the right decision in terms of her husband, which was true. But on the other hand, that she had children and she wanted to take care of them, and that what she ran into is that she would get beat up, and so she would run away from her husband with her 3 kids, and because he never would let her finish high school or take a job that paid more than him, she didn't have the work experience to then be able to get a job and feed 3 children. And so in the period when she got beat up, she had to turn to social welfare programs, and that they really were important. In the midst of a crisis, my sister needed shelter. She needed somebody to be able to listen to her and help her. She would obviously go to friends to get emotional support, or, you know, when she was back in the Bay Area, family could give her, or at least I could give her some support. But one of the dilemmas with the social service system was that my sister, and like most of the families I've known growing up, and the stats show, is most families do not want to be on welfare. It is needed when there is a crisis, like when she had to run away. But as soon as she got her wherewithal, which was, you know, a few days or a few weeks, that she would go get a job. And again, the kind of, and the level of job she got, she couldn't actually support her 3 kids. And she was left with, well, then do I go back on welfare, which she didn't want to do, or do I go back to that man who each time would promise he's never going to do it again, and for 6 months he wouldn't until he got frustrated and he'd take it out on her. And finally she ultimately ran away, and she again couldn't afford to raise the kids, so she left them, and obviously that created another crisis within the family. So the system we have right now was not helpful either to my mother or to my sister, except during a crisis. And the fact is that most of the stats people get, and they want to do charity and social service, is for people once they get in crisis. And the dilemma is we don't have a system that helps people to not end up in a crisis, to be able to get that independence. And that's really what I was seeking after I lost my mother. Just to continue the story and certainly break in anytime, Steve, but I had seen this as I was growing up and became an adult. And after I lost my mother, I did go back to Berkeley to get a degree in design. And as I was getting that degree, a master's, that I had to decide, did I want to pursue a career in design? Or at that point, I was offered a job in a new nonprofit that was a community development agency in San Francisco. And it was a chance to actually work with gang kids, some of which I knew when I'd been growing up when I was younger. But so whether I would join the War on Poverty or pursue a job in design, and I decided to join the War on Poverty. And so what I didn't want to happen is to have what happened to my family be happening to other families. And so I thought that with a War on Poverty that there must be a way to actually form something that would be much more supportive so that other families didn't go through what my family went through. So, Steve, let me stop there and see how you want to pursue this.
Well, I think that's really excellent. And again, you know, and that was probably back in the 70s. So at that point, you know, you were ready to see if you could make a difference. And that sounds like what you tried to do. So let's continue with that story. While you're, you know, so as you are working with these kids and so on and in this poverty program, mm-hmm. what was it that you discovered? Where were your successes and where was the program not successful?
Well, you know, like we had the agency that ultimately, I became the executive director of, was considered very successful. So we had a really good placement rate, and the kids that graduated on average had an increase in income of at least 8%. They were, you know, they were able to get jobs. And I knew that we had helped them. The trouble was within about 10 or 15 years, I was there for 20 years, I start seeing the kids of those first kids I trained start showing up in my program. And it was frustrating because I knew I had helped those kids initially, and now their kids were showing up, and I could see the condition of the family and that it had not fundamentally changed. And one of the dilemmas I found in the social sector is that in many ways, the programs all have short-term successes, but that given the thousands and thousands of programs and people that they help, that somehow or other, even though people had got episodic help, they had not been able to fundamentally change their position. And that you see in the growing gap between the rich and the poor. So the problems persist after 50 some years of the War on Poverty. I start seeing it in my programs that, again, I wasn't having a fundamental shift, which is the only reason I had come into the sector. The only reason my mother came to the United States, it wasn't to come here and either be a criminal or a rapist or to live in tolerable poverty. She came here to really get ahead, to really be a contributor. And she wanted to escape poverty. But most of the programs really try to make poverty tolerable. And that is not what I wanted, even for my programs. So the other piece is that I came to realize that my mother would never have gone through any of my programs. They were too paternal to have some 26-year-old MSW out of Berkeley trying to tell my mother what to do was never going to work. And the other thing was that now I was middle income and I could afford, you know, tutors for my kids. I would not send my own nephew and nieces that had troubles like the rest of the community. I wouldn't send them through my own programs. And, you know, I got invited to the State of the Union address by Clinton because we were supposed to have some of the best programs in the country, but I wouldn't send my own family through my own programs. So to me, it's like, why would I send anybody through these programs? So I became very, very discouraged with my own services and my 120 staff and $10 million budget that, you know, it would have been better if I just gave people the money.
You know, it's really interesting because if you look back at the history of immigration in this country, my grandparents came here from Russia about 115, 120 years ago. Of course, there was no social service program. And so my grandfather and his cronies started something when they reached Brooklyn. They started something called the Williamsburg Community Society, and that's exactly what it was. First of all, they provided cemetery plots for people because people died. It was also a social organization. It's how my parents met, through the Williamsburg Community Society. And also, this is before both welfare and unemployment and Social Security, they had something called Loan of Relief, which was if somebody in the community, somebody who was a member, then we all, everybody paid dues, needed, if they were out of work or they had an illness or something happened in their family that prevented them from working, they got an interest-free loan from the community society, which of course they had to pay back. And again, being part of this network, this community network, that was the only thing that existed in 1900 or 1910 that enabled people to all pull themselves up by their own bootstraps together and have, if not the next generation, then the next generation of children go to college. You know, my parents didn't go to college, but my brother and I did, and my cousins, most of my cousins did. So when we had the very necessary welfare programs that you're talking about for crisis situations, then apparently those got reified as institutions. And then if you didn't have the exact problem that they were ready to deal with, you're in that stage where you've already launched yourself and you need just a little bit of help. It wasn't available for those people. So you started this program in 2001, where you pitched Jerry Brown. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and I learned a lot in that project, which is one of the dilemmas I had is that, you know, I got invited to State of the Union address at a time when I was totally discouraged with my services. And about 9 months after I attended the State of the Union address, that I got a call from Jerry Brown, because my programs were known and I had met him before. And basically he was complaining that at that point, after some 30-some years of the war on poverty, that we had not fundamentally changed anything. That, you know, again, we'd made poverty tolerable for people that actually met our criteria, but other than that, nothing had fundamentally changed. And I tended to agree with him. And so then he asked me, so if you could do anything you wanted to do, and money and regulations or whatever weren't a problem, what would you do when you come into my office next month and tell me? And, you know, it was amazing to meet somebody who, you know, didn't have the same box. You know, he didn't live in a box the way the rest of us often had to, and that made you think in this much more broad way. And so for 2 weeks, I thought about anything I would do, and I knew social services, and I knew policy and whatever. And after 2 weeks of going through everything in terms of trying to come up with a solution that I would tell Jerry, that I realized I didn't know, but I had this meeting. And so when I was at the city hall to meet with him, he turned around and says, okay, so what would you do? And I said, well, I don't know what I would do, but I think most mothers, fathers, and guardians would have a better idea of what to do for themselves and their kids. And so I told them what I would do is I have a journaling system that I developed in the 90s, and that I would then, if he helps me put it online and give everybody a computer, I would ask these families what they would do to actually help themselves. And that what my mother used to lament is exactly what you explained, Steve, which is that it used to be about community. She said in Mexico, you know, there was a sense of community. We all help each other, and that's who you would turn to. And here it's all about programs, and that community and that sense of community is really broken down. And so I told Jerry that what I would do is I would only enroll families in groups with their friends. They would select their friends, and I would not enroll individuals. I would just enroll them with their friends. And we would ask them, so what would you do if you could do anything that, you know, was a practical thing to do? And you tell us what that is every month online, and we'll pay you for the time that it takes you, because that would give us data that I normally would pay outsiders. And within 2 years of just doing that, and I had promised Jerry, okay, there'll be no outside help from my staff, no counselors, no social workers. Let's just see what the capacity is of families to help themselves and help each other. And that's what Jerry decided to back. And so within 2 years, incomes start jumping up. And that was that fascinating story when the groups that were African-American, their income jumped 37%. The Asians group only jumped 18%, but they actually stopped a gang war in their communities. And the Latinos, which actually was one of the stories that we wanted to tell, the Latinos were refugees from the war in El Salvador. These were not the immigrant groups that came here with a lot of hope and energy. These were refugees, both in the Asian community and in the Latino community. And that there was one group that came from the war in El Salvador. And when we first engaged them, we asked them what your goals were. And their goals really were to go back to El Salvador, obviously, when the war calmed down, and that they just wanted to stay healthy and make sure their kids didn't get in trouble. And some other, well, nothing's going to change a whole lot for them. And about 7 months into the project, my staff came in and said, so there's this kind of family that's always been really quiet, and they said they're going to buy a house. And we think that they're involved with a predatory lender, and he seems to be taking deposits from them and not giving them receipts. And can we warn them about predatory lender, or could we send them to financial training or whatever? And I tell them, well, no, you can't say anything, because I already promised Jerry Brown, that we would not counsel or do anything. And so my staff was not very happy with me. And so that process continued, and then my staff comes back and says, well, yes, they did close on the house, and the problem is that the mortgage payment that this guy left them with is 65% of their income, and at 65% of their income, there's no way they're going to be able to keep the house. And I'm looking at them, they're looking at me, and I'm over there, yeah, there's no way they're going to keep the house. And so my staff was really mad at me. And then that's when the lessons start. Somewhere along the line, they did realize, you know, it wasn't Bernie Madoff or whatever, but they did realize that he was a scam artist, and that what they did is they got a refinance clause put into their final payments, papers. And so what they then did is, once it closed, they knew they couldn't afford it, but what they did is they got all their friends that they had borrowed money from in order to do the down payment and everything, to descend on the house. They repainted, retiled it, re-landscaped it, got the valuation of the house up. Then they had me, because I still spoke some Spanish at the time, sit in on a refinance. They got their mortgage down to about 40% of their income, and at 40% of their income, with this group of families surrounding them, there's no way that they were going to lose the house, and they still own that house 20 years later almost. And so it was like, well, that's pretty fascinating. They came up with their own solution of, really, this is a community house, and you helped us get it, you helped us keep it. So that was the first lesson. Then, because the program
I'm going to interrupt you, Mauricio, because we have a break coming up in about a half a minute. We come back, we'll hear more about some of these successful programs. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki, and we'll be back after these short messages.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential, so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible.
Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Hi, Steve Behrman back here on Wiki Politiki with our guest Mauricio Miller, and we're going deep into some of the issues related to how people actually do learn self-reliance. You told us a really heartening story where you essentially held off on helping in a way you knew you could. You knew these people were going down the wrong road, and yet you withheld the help, and lo and behold, they helped themselves, and that also impacted the rest of their community, didn't it?
Yeah, so it was kind of a fascinating trip for me. I actually felt bad that I couldn't and wouldn't let my staff provide any counseling advice when the families start using this lender that obviously was a predatory lender. The thing that started happening after they purchased the house and after their friends helped them bring the mortgage payment down is that we were tracking the rest of the group. I think it was another five families that were from the war in El Salvador. And for all of that group, they had previously been sending any savings they had back to El Salvador. And so the line for savings, since we track their income, we track their savings, we track their debt, et cetera. We had a big tracking system to see what was happening to the family. All of a sudden, the red line for savings for the other five families start going up. And before, it had been nothing. And then all of a sudden, I decided to go to the meeting, and I asked them, so, you know, you had not been saving any money before. You'd all been sending it back to El Salvador. So how come you're all saving now? And they got this big smile on their face, and they turned over to Javier Maria and says, well, if they can buy a house, we can buy a house. So now all of them start saving because Javier Maria was able to do it, and they actually did not even do a good job in how they went about it. They knew it could be done. Within 18 months, all the other five families owned homes in the United States. Something that was pointed out because one of their own that was in their situation was able to do, and they could learn from it. And so, again, this is not something I could program. This is something that really was inspired within the community. And, again, there's history that shows us how the black townships were built. When people would see somebody succeed, then they'd start a barbershop in the next area to start that. And so that role modeling piece I knew then was really, really important. So that was the second lesson I got is, again, how an idea and a success permeates a community because it's their solution. The third lesson they told me was that we're not the only ones now that are buying homes. Other people in our refugee community are now buying homes. And I thought, well, that's really great. So about 15 years later, this is about 2016, 2017, I did a presentation at Stanford University at this conference, and I told the Javier and Maria story. And afterwards, this young man came up to me, and he said, so, you know, my mother heard about your families buying homes back in the early 2000s, and because of that, my family decided to buy a house, and it's the equity from that house that has got me through Stanford. So I knew that that solution that they came up with and that started spreading had impacted generationally, and now the expectations had been changed, something, again, that my programs could never do. But you had to trust, and you have to let people make their own mistakes. And then you have to just be supportive of the fact that we're all like that. We all make mistakes, but we all have so much to contribute.
Wow, what a heartening story. The exact opposite outcome of, you know, finding that the children of the people that you work with are back in the same situation. So clearly they were able to build equity and succeed inside the system as it is. There was nothing in the system that needed to change for them to succeed?
Well, the thing is that, and that's what happened, you know, in my family, is that there were positive deviants, what are called positive deviants. This is all part of people, if they want to learn more about how things scale naturally, they should read the book Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. Mm-hmm. And in more technical terms, it's called diffusion of innovation, how Facebook spread, how do ideas spread, how do something new spreads. And what it does is it takes what's called a positive deviant. So that was Javier and Maria, that they were able to get around the barriers by helping each other and whatever. And that then there were the early adopters, which were these other families. The dilemma that happens is that in order for an idea to really, it often is held back by other structural issues. So the fact that in this community they were tight enough that they could have friends help, you know, with down payments and whatever, really was in some ways exceptional. So I think there is a role for outsiders, and there is a role for then changing the system so that there isn't the kind of redlining that wouldn't allow families like these to get a loan, to get a home loan. So there are mm-hmm. structural issues that if we want things to spread, that in many ways, because we're in the way, and it's not just that the program's in the way, you know, banks are in the way, and some of the structures and credit ratings are certainly in the way. You have one crisis in your family, and it's going to take years for you to rebuild your credit rating, even though it was an episodic crisis of maybe saving your son or daughter from something. But, you know, it's ruined your credit. So there are a lot of things that actually can be done to try to make sure that once there is an idea that shows you can get through it, you can get around structural barriers, you can't assume everybody's going to be able to get around a structural barrier. You have to then start breaking down some of those barriers.
You know, of course, you know, we all grew up in this country on the so-called Horatio Alger stories where, you know, somebody overcomes great odds and they're able to make it. And that's the other, you know, again, those are the exceptions, and it doesn't count all of those who drowned in the process. So if mm-hmm. you were really going to design a program anew, if you were going to address Congress, or you had a platform that would have the attention of large numbers of people, what would you say about how we address poverty, how we essentially help all of us out of that situation, and how do we empower people who've been told either subtly or not so subtly that they're not capable?
Well, obviously, if it was just an issue of getting in front of a large audience and telling people what to do, then we would have gotten over this, you know, about 15 years ago when I started this whole project. And so it has never been an issue of having the message. It's really about having the message accepted. And getting the message accepted actually requires people getting over a lot of the prejudice and stereotypes that they hold, you know, very close to themselves, both on the liberal and conservative side, mm-hmm. the stereotypes that people like my and it's obvious that, you know, whether it's LGBT or tobacco or whatever, getting society's perceptions to change is not a really easy thing, but it can happen. And so rather than a speech, I think what we actually have to do is be able to get these stories and get the data, because it all exists, and there's behavioral studies and census studies and whatever, and be able to present it in a way that's acceptable. And I think the way, and those that maybe could gravitate, the early adopters, are those that see this as a win-win situation, that what we have is we have 7.7 billion people in the world, and 75% of them, 6 billion people, live around poverty. This is 70% of the world's population are seen as takers from society, as poverty cases, as people that need charity. And we never see them as assets. And yet, this is like 75% of the world's population that, you know, I think has talents, like my mother had talent and my sister had talent. And we have no mechanism to recognize them or treat them and invest in them in the way that we would for those that are privileged. So if somehow or other we could see that, look at, even if I'm a corporation, if even some of these 6 billion people have more income, they're going to buy my computer, or they're going to actually buy some of, you know, my clothing, or they're going to, you know, that, you know, even if you look at it from a corporate side, it's like I could have more consumers. And if you look at it from a neighborhood side, it's like these are people that, you know, if they have their stores and they're building up, they're going to take care of their neighborhood because they have something to take care of. And the kids are not getting in trouble, as I've seen other communities, once the community comes together. You know, we start solving a lot of the problems that we try solving through programs or silos or charity. The families will be able to solve them together, and it will be that change in community, that change in mindset within the community. So a lot of it for me is that, can we actually get across to people that if we want these wars to stop, if we really want to get along, if we want to stop using stereotypes, you know, about each other and about who's right and who's wrong, if we want all that, then we have to look at people more in terms of what's good in them, not in terms of what their weaknesses are, which is really what charity does. Charity tries to actually help make you feel guilty about something. If you feel guilty enough, then you'll contribute. And that's not, you know, what my mother wanted. She didn't, almost nobody I've known growing up wants charity. Maybe after a crisis you do, and that's all you can really hope for at that time. But seriously, what we have is 6 billion people that want to be seen for what they really are and want to be seen for what really is in them in terms of talents. And then as they show that, that there is support for it. There isn't a stereotype, but there isn't a barrier, but that actually they can do something with it. So that's more the message, you know, now getting that message across and getting the early adopters to really help us push that message really is going to take a little bit more work.
So that leaves me with two questions in the 5 or so minutes we have left. First question is, how do we build the communities that are not naturally there? You have a group of people who've immigrated from the same place. There's a natural affinity. But we find that if we're in the second generation, already these people have become, quote unquote, Americanized. They are alone with their personal device. There's not that sense. Is there a way that sense of connection and community can be cultivated without imposing it?
Well, it's really kind of interesting because in many ways we've tried to do that. I think we did it very structurally when we started my project from Jerry Brown, the Family Independence Initiative. We basically said, we're not going to deal with you unless you come in with a bunch of your friends, right? You go self-recruit, and that was like a requirement. What happened is when it was required that they come in with friends, then they start realizing that their friends were better, had better solutions than my staff, which wasn't allowed to say anything. And so they did turn to one another. The other thing is that was done in an ecosystem that told them that, seriously, do you want my staff, which is like 30 years old, to tell you what to do? I mean, you just survived a war in El Salvador or a war in Vietnam, and you're the only experts of your own lives. And I have Jerry Brown here who believes that you probably have your best solutions, and so we want to learn from you. In an ecosystem, when it becomes clear to people that you trust them more than you trust some professional that because they went through UC Berkeley, when that is the situation, when they're teaching us, it really changes the dynamic. And when they start saying that what we pay the most attention to is group efforts, then all of a sudden group efforts start happening. So as we tracked mutuality, because we tracked data in that project, as we tracked mutuality, we saw that within 6 months, when we told them that really what we're interested in is how you guys will help each other and you show us and give us that data, mutuality jumped 60% within 6 months. People start turning to one another. It's just that we had spent so much time in society talking about individualism and you make it yourself and you compete and whatever, that in many ways we were breaking down what really is a natural tendency of people wanting to work with each other. And when we said, no, really, well, we're interested in how you will work with each other, then it just started happening much more naturally. So, yes, we can set up an ecosystem that isn't about heroes or individualism or whatever. When we start actually paying attention to and honoring how people help one another and make those stories, not the hero stories, but make that mutuality story actually really clear, people will gravitate very naturally to those networks because that's how people survived in the old days. That's how your community and other communities did. We just, you know, have to get and have to really fight this individual hero mentality or program as the hero mentality, and really start talking and actually honoring how people really do help each other, and more will do that.
Wow. Wow. What an amazing point. You know, one of the things about learning is when you see something that has been in plain sight and somebody points it out to you. And in a certain regard, we have been so hypnotized by the cult of the individual. You know, and here we have, you know, when I was a kid, you know, in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Dodger baseball players lived in the community. Gil Hodges lived over, in this neighborhood, and Jackie Robinson lived over there. And now, of course, the players are paid so much that they're in a place of their own, where it's not so much the team as these particular pieces that are put together that are free agents that represented by agents who make money on them. And so we have a brilliant solution by our friend Mauricio Miller. His book is called The Alternative. I wish we had a lot more time, but he's left you with a number of really golden gems. So thank you, Mauricio, for being our guest on Wiki Politiki. This is Steve Behrman.
Thank you.
And we'll be with you next week. Thank you, Mauricio. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Steve.